So today we're going to finish talking about quantum algorithms. So we were talking about unstructured search before, and we started talking about, well, you know, we saw the details of how Grover's algorithm worked. So we saw that you can solve this unstructured search problem in big O of square root of n queries. And now what we would like to see is that actually that's optimal. So we started discussing that last time, and today we're going to finish the proof that actually square root of n is the best you can do. So we're going to see a quantum query lower bound that says that you need at least square root of n queries. And then this is going to be the last topic that we're going to do on quantum algorithms, and we're going to move on to talk about other aspects of quantum information processing. And the first thing that I'm going to do before we really get into specific topics is a really quick review of some things about open quantum systems. I know you're all familiar with like the basic concept of density matrices and quantum operations and these kind of things, but I just want to do like a really quick review just to make sure we're all on the same page. Okay, so let's get back to the optimality proof. So, we had a specific algorithm that worked, but now we want to argue, we want to somehow reason about general algorithms, right? So we want to show that any algorithm for solving the unstructured search problem will need like square root of n queries. Nope. Did somebody bring me a cupcake? All right, okay. Nobody. I didn't get the memo about the cupcakes. All right, I'm kidding. No, that was, I don't want to eat somebody's cupcake. All right, thank you. Wow, okay. I was kidding, but there's actually, that's amazing. Okay, thank you. I'm touched. Okay, so let's get back to the optimality proof. We're trying to see that we need square root of n queries to solve this problem, and we wanted to argue that this is really the case for a completely general algorithm. So we have an algorithm that consists of alternating operations between unitaries on the whole space that don't depend on the input and queries. So U sub x is the black box, and that's the only way we can get information out about the input. Okay, so this is a general T query algorithm with no assumption about how many wires there are here, how many qubits we have, how much workspace there is. And we want to somehow argue that we need a lot of queries. And we talked last time about the strategy for that. So we said that we're going to let psi sub I be the state after, just before we make the I plus first query. So in other words, right after we do the ith unitary operation that doesn't depend on the black box, in the case where there's no marked item. So psi sub, or let me call it psi sub little t, is the state just before the t plus first query, or in the case psi sub capital T, the very last state of the algorithm, when there's no marked item. And we're going to show that it's hard to distinguish the case of no marked item from the case of one marked item. And then psi sub t superscript I is the same thing where the marked item is I. And I could be any one of the n things, of course. And to show that this is hard, we really need to keep in mind that the marked item could be any of the items. It's not hard to distinguish the case of no marked item from the case where the first item is marked, because then you just query the first item. So somehow we have to get into the analysis that we don't know what the marked item is and that we have to distinguish this case from all of these cases. So what we said last time was, we're going to look at a quantity, which is this thing, for a general value t, for a general step in the algorithm. We're going to look how this particular number evolves in the course of a general algorithm. And we know, first of all, that quantity is initially zero because at the very beginning of the algorithm, you have to start with some state that doesn't depend on the contents of the black box because you haven't queried the black box yet. So the state psi sub zero is the same as the state psi sub zero I. So that means that this distance between the states is zero. But now if we demand that the algorithm succeeds after capital T queries, then if we sum up this quantity over all the items, that has to be at least n times epsilon. Because if we want to succeed with some constant probability, then there has to be some constant distance between these states for all I. Right? So this thing for any one I has to be at least epsilon. And so when I sum over all of them, it has to be at least n times epsilon. Right? So that's the basic idea. We want to look at how this quantity evolves. We know that it starts at zero, and it has to become very big. It has to become linear in n by the end of the day if we're to actually compute the thing that we want to compute. So now we want to show that it has to you know, that it can only be increased by a small amount every time we make a query. If we can do that, then that will show us what we want to show. All right, so here's the lemma that we're going to prove, which is going to show this. So if I look at the difference of this quantity in going from step t to step t plus 1, I have it written as from step t minus 1 to t. So here the sum I goes from 1 to n of, okay, so first let's look at what this quantity is at the tth step. So psi sub t minus psi sub t I. So I sum that thing up overall I. That's the quantity that I care about. And I'm going to look at the difference between that and what happens at the t minus one position. Right? So I want to claim that this sum is small, and what I claim in particular is that this is at most 2 root n, almost twice the square root of the number of marked items. And clearly, if we can show that, it's going to show us what we want, because we know that this thing has to become at least n, and if it can only increase by root n every time we make a query, that means we must have to make big O of root n queries, or sorry, we have to make big omega of root n queries in order to actually solve the problem. Right? So if we can prove this lemma, then we're done. All right. So why is this true? Well, what we should do is we should just take a look at this quantity and see how it can change when we make a query. Right, so the basic thing that we care about here, is this. We want to know, how does the state change when we make a query? And not just how does the state change, but what can we say about the difference between the state and the case where there's no marked item and where the marked item is I, right? Okay, so what is this quantity? Well, the way you get this from the t minus 1 position of the algorithm is that you apply two unitaries, right? You apply first the query and then some unitary operation that doesn't depend on the query, right? So specifically, this is, this is going to be v t minus 1 times ux. Let me write u sub I. So u sub I is going to mean the black box corresponding to the x, where the marked item is I, right? So this is kind of, it means the same thing as the, I guess maybe one thing I could write, which would be like E sub I, right? So E sub I is like the ith standard basis vector. So it's the vector where you have all zeros except a one in the ith position. I guess that's consistent with the notation that I have, right? So this, but in the case where there's no marked item, this is the state for the case where I have no marked item. So when there's no marked item, actually, the corresponding unitary is the identity because nothing is getting marked. So no phases are being introduced. So this is going to be, just psi sub t, actually. Right? So that's the way the state evolves when there's no marked item. And when the ith item is marked, then we have vt minus 1 u e sub I, psi t I, right? Okay, so this is how the state changes, and it changes differently in the two cases because here the ith item is marked and here there's no marked item. Is that okay? All right, so now what can we say about this, okay? So first of all, one of the things that makes it difficult to reason about algorithms is that there are lots of things you could do. These Vs could be absolutely anything. You have all the freedom in the world to choose anything that you want. But actually, this expression does not depend on what V is, right? Can you see why? Right, V is a unitary, right? So this is just V sub t minus 1 acting on some vector. That vector is, psi t minus u, V sub I, acting on psi t I, right? So it's a unitary acting on some state, and unitary transformations preserve the lengths of vectors, right? So this is exactly the same thing as psi sub t minus u, E sub I, acting on psi t I. Right, so I mean the vector is different, but the length of the vector is the same, right? Okay, so now something else that I could do, which is going to be turns out that it's going to be kind of a helpful thing, is to move u over to the other side, right? So that I claim that this is actually the same as u e sub I acting on psi t. So in other words, I mean, now there's like no nice interpretation of what's going on. I'm just manipulating this expression mathematically, but I'm just gonna put it on the other side. So now it's like I'm doing nothing in the case where the ith item is marked, and I'm actually doing the unitary that I would do as if the ith item were marked in the case where no item is marked. So that's like, I mean, that's sort of a silly thing to do, right? I mean, that has no interpretation in terms of what's actually happening in the algorithm. But as a mathematical expression, this is correct, right? Because I can multiply by any unitary transformation, and that's going to keep the length of the vector the same. And well, this thing happens to be its own inverse, right? So if I multiply by u through this whole thing, then I'm going to have that term appearing here, and it's going to go away over here. Right? Okay, so that's something that I can do. And now what I can do is I can sort of split this up into a sum of two terms and use the triangle inequality to bound them separately, right? So, I want to, this t should have been t minus 1, right? I mean, this is what happened, when I came from the previous step. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so... now, what I can do is I can sort of, add and subtract psi sub t minus 1, right? So, this is certainly equal to u e sub I psi sub t minus 1, minus psi sub t minus 1 plus psi sub t minus 1 minus psi sub t minus 1 I, right? Here, I really didn't do anything. I just added and subtracted some vector, right? So this is just 0, so this is clearly the same thing. But now what I can do is I can use the triangle inequality, and I can separately compare this to this and this to this, right? And that's useful because if I compare this to this, now I'm just comparing how things were at the previous step, right? That's exactly the term that I have over here. Right? So this is at most, so by the triangle inequality, this is at most, so u e sub I acting on psi t minus 1, minus psi t minus 1 plus psi t minus 1 minus psi sub t minus 1 I, right? So now what I've done is I've said, well, the difference between these two states is, I can express that as the difference that I had at the previous step plus some increment. And one thing which is nice is that when I want to look at what that increment is, I don't have to worry about what the state was in the case where the ith item was marked. I just have some fixed state, but then I'm doing some I-dependent operation on it. So this is kind of simplified what I have to understand. Right? So this term, if I were to move this term over to the left-hand side, now what I have is exactly this quantity that I care about. So I really just want to take this thing, and I want to understand what this is. Right? So suppose I have some particular state, and I want to look at how big the difference can be between that state and that state where I make a query on it, right? And if I can say that I can't change, any state very much when I apply a query to it, then what that says is this quantity can't increase very much. Right? That's sort of the nature of the argument. Okay. So now what we have to do is just sort of like, reason about this state, and we don't know what that state is, of course, right? Because an algorithm could do lots of different things. But whatever that state is, it consists of various amplitudes for querying the different possible items. So let's just expand it in that way. Let's just say suppose psi sub t minus 1 equals, so it's going to be some kind of a sum over amplitudes for querying the different possible items, but then of course for every item that you might be querying, there could be a completely arbitrary state in the other register. Right, so just I can expand this thing like this. There's going to be some alpha j, which is the amplitude for querying the jth item, and then there could be some state phi sub j in the other register, and I have no control over what phi j could be because I could have written anything in the workspace whatsoever. Okay, but now what I can do is I can understand what happens when I act with u sub e sub I on this, right? So the u corresponding to the ith item being marked, acting on psi sub t minus 1, will only flip the ith term in the sum, right? There's a unique marked item, so only one of these terms gets flipped. So this is going to be equal to minus alpha I phi sub I. So it flips the, we've got this phase oracle, so it's flipping the phase for the ith item. And then all of the other terms just stay the same, right? So this is you know, plus the sum over all j not equal to I, alpha j, j, I j. That's what happens when I perform a query. Yes?
Why is it not just zero?
Why is this not just zero?
On the first line, you said it was zero. Why isn't size of t minus 1 the one that doesn't have a mark, right? So if we actually
think that. Oh, yeah, right. So, but that's because, you know, this is this weird thing that has no interpretation in terms of what's actually going on, right? So this is the state that you would have if there were no marked item. This is the operation that you would do if the ith item is marked. So this is not something that you should write down if you're talking about how the algorithm actually behaves. Because in the case where there's no marked item, then you're actually doing nothing to it. But that's not what this says, right? This says, suppose you take the state, that's the state you would get after t minus 1 queries, if there's no marked item, but then, you know, poof, the kind of the ith item becomes marked, and then you apply the unitary. So it's, I mean, it's a little bit weird to write something like this, but that's what we have in this way of, you know, kind of calculating.
So in the actual algorithm to control the unitary, essentially, but we're just applying whatever.
I mean, in the algorithm, it's something which would flip the phase, of the ith item, and now we're flipping the phase of the ith item on the state that we would have gotten if there were no marked item. But you know, that's just what we're doing. Okay, good. So this is what happens. I mean, I agree, yes, it doesn't kind of correspond to anything that happens in the real algorithm, but certainly this is a legitimate mathematical expression. And now what I want to do is I want to understand, now what happens if I look at the difference between this and the case where I do nothing. So in other words, I want to compute u sub e sub I minus the identity acting on psi t minus 1. So what's the difference between doing this and doing nothing? And all of this stuff is going to go away, because all of this stuff is also going to be there in the case where, I have the identity acting. And but now I'm subtracting off again this same term. I'm subtracting it off twice, right? So I'm going to get here minus 2 alpha I phi sub I, but all of the terms corresponding to things that I'm not querying, right here I'm querying the I thing, all of the terms corresponding to indices I'm not querying, they go away. So this is all that I have. Now, I can't say whether this is big or small, right? Because whether this is big or small depends on what I was querying. I could have happened to have put all my amplitude on querying the ith item, and then, you know, this could be pretty big. This could be of order 1. The length of this vector. If I don't put much amplitude on querying the ith thing, then it'll be small. But notice that I can't put all of my amplitude on querying everything, right? I have to choose to put it somewhere. So if I choose to query the ith item, then I'm learning more about querying the ith item, but I'm learning less about querying other things. So somehow we have to understand how that trade-off plays out. Ultimately what we want to do, so this thing that we want to calculate, going back to that calculation, we have that the difference between, so psi t minus psi t I minus psi t minus 1 minus psi t minus 1 I, right, this thing I upper bounded by, the norm of this vector, right? Because this vector is the vector that appears here. So I upper bounded this by the length of this, and the length of this is just twice the norm of alpha I, right? Okay, so that's what I know. But now the expression that appears in the lemma takes this thing and it sums it over all I. So that's the quantity that I care about if I want to say that this thing has to work for all the items. So, you know, it's not true that any one of the alpha i's has to be small, but in some sense, the sum over all of the alpha i's has to be small. And we want to make that quantitative, right? So now what we want to do is we want to take the sum of the alpha i's, and we want upper bound that. Because this is this is our upper bound on the right-hand side of the expression, right? If we can show that this is at most 2 root n, then we're done. So how can we show that? What do we want to use? Yeah, so this thing goes by different names. I would call it the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Yeah, but it's, that's right. So you want to use an inequality that relates the sum of the first powers to the sum of the second powers, right? It's the thing that relates the L1 norm to the L2 norm. It's like, this is like one of the most useful inequalities everywhere, anywhere. It shows up all over the place, right? So we want to say how this thing relates to this, you know, L1 norm of this vector of amplitudes, how that relates to the L2 norm. And the way it relates is by a factor of the square root of the length of the vector, right? So this is where the square root is coming from, at least in this way of looking at what's going on, right? So this is at most, well, there's this factor of 2, but 2 times the square root of n times the sum I equals 1 to n of length of alpha I squared, right? So when you change from the L1 norm to the L2 norm, you know, they're related by some factor. Norms in general are related by some factor, but it can be dimension dependent. And here the dimension dependent factor is exactly the square root of n, right? So if you're not familiar with this, like the way that you kind of see that this is true in terms of vectors is that, you know, what the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality says is that if you take the inner product between two vectors and you look at the length of that, that's at most the, you know, that's at most the product of the lengths, right? So like the square root of a dot a, b dot b, right? And if you take b to just be the vector of all ones, then this thing is just n, right? So there's a factor of square root of n that you get if you want to replace the sum of the components of a with, you know, the length of a. Okay, good. So that's how you see that this inequality is true. And now what is the sum from I equals 1 to n of alpha I squared? Well, these are the amplitudes in a quantum state, right? This is supposed to be a normalized quantum state where these things are unit vectors and these are just the amplitudes for querying each of the things. So this is just, this sum is just 1. So this is 2 root n. Right? So that's what we wanted to show. Questions about that? Is that okay? Okay, good. So this shows, you know, I guess we should just kind of wrap up, right? So what this shows us is that if we take, you know, the sum I equals 1 to n of, you know, psi t minus the psi t I, you know, for any t, well, the amount that this quantity can increase every time we make a query, you know, from one value of t to the next, is at most 2 root n. So for any particular t, this is going to be at most 2 root n times t. Right? This value started out at 0 and increased by at most 2 root n every time we took a step. And so this is how big the value can be after t queries. Right? So to succeed, what do we need? Well, this value, 2 times root n times t, is going to have to be at least n times epsilon, right? And that tells me that t has to be at least epsilon over 2 times root n, right? So no matter what algorithm I use, I have to make omega of root n queries. So this is a lower bound on the quantum query complexity. Okay, so this is like maybe the simplest example of a quantum lower bound, but this area of, you know, coming up with lower bounds on quantum query complexity is a really interesting one, and there's, you know, a lot of stuff that we don't have time to talk about. So, you know, one thing that maybe I'll just mention quickly is that this, you can view this as an instance of a more general lower bound technique that you can use to prove lower bounds on quantum query in general, which is what's called the quantum adversary method. And there's a version of this method, which is called the generalized adversary method, that you can think of it as a method for proving lower bounds on quantum query algorithms. And you can actually compute the value of this, you know, the best adversary lower bound you can prove in this method using a certain kind of optimization problem, something called a semi-definite program. I don't know if this is something you've heard about, but it's something that appears in this area called convex optimization. And in these sort of, you know, optimization problems, there's a notion of duality, where from some optimization problem where you're trying to you know, where you're trying to maximize something, so you're trying to prove as good a lower bound as possible, you can come up with a dual problem where you're trying to minimize something, where you're trying to make something as small as possible. And, you know, from the dual of this semi-definite program, you can prove, well, you know, upper bounds on the best lower bound that you could prove, you know, by that method, which is maybe not so interesting. But a pretty amazing thing happens that actually the dual of this semi-definite program is closely related to algorithms. So not only can you put limitations on lower bounds, but you can really come up with upper bounds on the query complexity by taking the dual. And this is something that's just been understood like over the last, you know, 3-4 years, something like that. And it's really led to a lot of kind of interesting developments in quantum query complexity and understanding kind of, well, quantum query algorithms that we didn't know about before, and understanding more general things about quantum query complexity. So there's lots of really interesting stuff that we just kind of don't have time to talk about, but that would be something to look into more if you're interested in this kind of stuff. Yes?
So if we assume that all we're doing is unitary operations, I can see that this should be the most general thing we could do. But
right.
What if we incorporated measurements or something? Because it's already going to be a probabilistic algorithm.
Right. That's true. Yeah. So, the very next thing we're going to do is this like quick review of open quantum systems. And there's going to be kind of a theme there, which is that whenever you think about doing something, that's not necessarily unitary, but you allow, maybe you allow measurements, or you allow, interaction with some larger system where you have to describe the system by a density matrix, you can always effectively view that in terms of, what happens to some pure quantum state. So if you think about measurements, you never have to perform measurements. You can always defer the measurements until later on and just do things conditioned on the value of some quantum register that stores something that later on will be measured, but stores the value of the measurement. And more generally, just, anything. So the most general sort of algorithm you could have would have not necessarily unitary transformations there, but just quantum operations. So, I'll remind you in a second what those are, but, you could replace these things by arbitrary quantum operations, which could be, they could be measurements, or they could be just some non-unitary quantum operations. But whatever you do, you could always get back into the picture that looks like this by purifying everything.
So we're reviewing this as whatever our whole system is, measurement apparatus and all is part of this.
Exactly. That's right. So, that's like a very formal thing, but it sort of says that you're never going to get anything better by considering that model than by considering this model. And so this, this lower bound is not somehow a lower bound that's specific to quantum algorithms that use unitaries. It really holds for completely arbitrary quantum algorithms. Yes?
So you said that we knew about this lower bound before the discovery of the algorithm.
Someone did, yeah. I mean, I didn't, but but someone did. Right. Right. I mean, we didn't use any of the properties of the algorithm when we proved this lower bound.
Are there examples of problems in which you have to have an algorithm to say something about complexity, or is there something very general about complexity that's completely independent of any method you use to solve the problem?
Right. I mean, somehow when you're trying to put a lower bound on the query complexity of solving some problem, or you're trying to put an upper bound on the query complexity, you're doing very different things, right? I mean, in one case, you're trying to just come up with some specific procedure that will solve the problem. And on the other side, you're trying to show that absolutely no algorithm will be able to solve the problem. So, that's usually the harder thing to do, actually, which is part of the reason it's surprising that that was the thing that was known first here. But it's just a very different kind of thing. So I don't think you have to know, any specific algorithm to come up with a good lower bound. And on the other hand, if you have a good lower bound, that doesn't necessarily tell you how to come up with a good algorithm. But, that's what's so interesting, I think, about this thing that I was very quickly mentioning about the generalized adversary method and semi-definite programming, that somehow, there is some way of viewing both upper and lower bounds as two sides of the same optimization problem through this semi-definite programming duality. And it's just a really interesting connection, and it's really powerful because it lets you show a lot of things that that weren't known without that connection. Other questions? Okay, so then the next thing that I wanted to do was just like really quickly remind you about stuff having to do with open quantum systems. Most of which I guess you will have seen before, but maybe some of which you haven't. I want to talk a little bit about the characterization of quantum operations and maybe some characterizations that you probably won't have seen. Okay, so far, we've really focused entirely on what we can do with pure quantum states and unitary evolutions. But when we talk about some of the stuff that's coming up, for example, we want to talk about things like quantum data compression and quantum state discrimination and other sorts of things. It's really useful to work in a more general picture where we have not necessarily unitary operations, and we have quantum states that could be described, say, by density matrices. So I guess you're all familiar with this. So, you know, what is a density matrix? So this is something that describes what's called a mixed quantum state. And a mixed quantum state is described by a positive semi-definite matrix. The symbol that we use is usually rho, and it should satisfy that the trace of rho is 1. So that's the kind of thing which is analogous to having a unit vector when we talk about pure quantum states. And it should be positive semi-definite. So it should be, you know, Hermitian. And it should be, it should have non-negative eigenvalues. Okay. So I guess you know that if you have a pure quantum state psi, this corresponds to a density matrix, which is just the projector onto psi. So this density matrix description throws away this irrelevant global phase information. And if we have some ensemble of states where we have the state psi sub I with probability p sub I, then this corresponds to the corresponding convex combination of density matrices. So here rho would be the sum over I, p sub I, times the projector onto psi sub I. Okay. And, you know, there's also a nice kind of pictorial representation of these things if we think about mixed quantum states for qubits, right? So if we think about the Bloch sphere, which we talked about before, for, you know, pure states of qubits, the pure states live on the surface of the Bloch sphere, and the mixed quantum states are just the states in the interior of the Bloch sphere. So, for example, you know, if we have the state 0 and the state 1, we could also take the equally weighted combination of those two things, the state we get if we take either 0 or 1, each with probability a half, and that's going to be, you know, this thing, which is sometimes called the maximally mixed state, and that just corresponds to the point at the very center of the Bloch sphere. So that's the identity divided by 2, sometimes called the maximally mixed state. And there's not necessarily a unique representation for a given density matrix. So you can have different ensembles that are actually completely statistically indistinguishable. Like, for example, if I take the plus state and the minus state, then you see that the thing halfway in between them is also the maximally mixed state. So that's a different ensemble. If I take these each with probability half, that's a different ensemble that gives me exactly the same density matrix. Okay. Now, another kind of picture we can have is that, as we were discussing before, whenever we have this situation of open quantum systems, we can always imagine that they're realized by something where we have pure quantum states. So this process is called purification, and I guess you're also familiar with this. So for any density matrix of a quantum system that we might have, right? So for all quantum states rho A that we might think about, there exists some, in general, not unique, purification psi, which is a state of now a bipartite system. There's an A part and a B part that has the property that if you trace out the B part, which you can think of as the environment of the quantum system, then what you get is the density matrix of the mixed system. So you can always come up with some pure quantum state that realizes a density matrix in this way. And do you remember how you do this? I guess you've all seen this before, right? So how do I come up with a purification? It's not unique, as I said, but how would I come up with some state that would be the purification of a given density matrix? Are you not saying anything because you don't know or because this is too basic? Pardon? You can just diagonalize the thing, right? So if we just take rho and we write it as the sum over I of, you know, well, if we diagonalize this thing, we're going to have some probabilities p sub I, which are just the eigenvalues of the density matrix. You know, this is a decomposition that we can always write. And then from this, it's easy to come up with a density matrix that, well, let me call this thing, I don't know, these will be some states, let me call them phi sub I. So those are the eigenvectors of the density matrix. Then I can easily just come up with a quantum state which just labels the second register with, you know, which state we have here, right? So so then the state psi, which is the sum over I of the square root of p sub I, phi I, tensor I, is a state whose reduced density matrix for the first system is exactly rho, right? So that's easy to find out, to figure out if you just sort of like, you know, compute this matrix and then you take the partial trace over this thing. So the picture here is that the environment has a record of which state is in the first register. So it has this label that says what the state is for the first register. And by doing that, you can realize this mixed quantum state through a pure quantum state. Okay, good. So this is all hopefully very familiar. And then the next thing that I wanted to mention quickly was about quantum operations. So what are the valid transformations that we can perform on mixed quantum states? So a valid operation on mixed quantum states should be something that maps density matrices to density matrices. So what are the properties that that a quantum operation should have? So let me call this quantum operation script E. So certainly it should be linear. So, you know, just to respect the linearity of quantum mechanics, it should be the case that if I take E acting on some mixture, you know, P times rho plus Q times sigma, that should be the same thing as P times E of rho plus Q times E of sigma. It should preserve trace because density matrices have to have trace one. So the trace of E of rho should be, if rho is really a density matrix and it has trace one, then this thing should be one. But you know, you could even think about defining this for matrices that aren't required to have trace one. And then the rule should be this: since it's a linear operation, you should just get the trace of rho. And it should also preserve positivity, meaning that if rho is positive semi-definite, then E of rho should be positive semi-definite. Right? So then the question is this enough? Maybe you know the answer. So is this everything that we need? So if something satisfies all of these things, is it necessarily a quantum operation? I guess you can tell from the way I'm asking the question that the answer should be no, right? So there's actually more than this that needs to be true, which is that quantum operations have to be what's called completely positive. So it should be completely positive. So it's possible to be positive without being completely positive. And what that means is that the previous thing should be true even if we act with our quantum operation on part of a composite system, right? So if rho is positive semi-definite, and rho could be here a state not just of the space that E acts on, but on some larger space that E could act, where E could just act on some subsystem, then if I act with E, tensor product, the identity quantum operation, the thing that just sends rho to rho, this thing is acting on some state which is smaller than rho, the thing that sends, you know, sigma to sigma. So this acting on rho should also be positive semi-definite, right? So there are examples of quantum operations that are positive but not completely positive. So this really is a stronger condition that, you know, no matter how large a dimension of a system we allow this identity to act on, this thing still should be true. Do you know an example of a quantum operation that's positive but not completely positive? Yeah, so the transpose, I guess, is the thing which is, you know, positive but not completely positive. So if I take, the transpose of a positive semi-definite matrix, I get a positive semi-definite matrix. So it's positive, but if I act on just part of a composite quantum system, then it could map a quantum state. So in particular, it could map an entangled quantum state to a state that had negative eigenvalues. Right. Okay. So good. So you're familiar with this. So then the next thing that I wanted to do was give you some characterizations of when a quantum operation is completely positive. So there's this, you know, there are these conditions, some of which are easy to check, right? I mean, the fact that it should be trace preserving and the fact that it should be linear, these are sort of, you know, simple conditions. But this condition of complete positivity is a little bit weird, right? Because you need something to be true no matter how big the environment might be. And so it would be nice to sort of have some way of understanding, you know, how you might represent a quantum operation and, you know, what what sorts of conditions would be necessary and sufficient for it to really be a valid quantum operation. Okay, so here's a theorem, which I'm not going to prove, but just state. So we have these conditions. So the following are equivalent. So the first one is just that E is a quantum operation. So I'm going to say it's a completely positive trace-preserving map. So this is a completely positive linear map. Or in other words, sometimes we'll just say it is a quantum operation. Okay, so another possibility is that this thing has a Krauss representation. So this is probably something you've all also seen before. So E acting on rho is the sum over I, AI rho AI dagger, where there's some normalization condition that these AIs have to satisfy, which is basically, it's going to give us that this thing is trace preserving. So the sum over I, AI dagger AI, should be the identity. So this is called the Krauss representation. And I think you've seen this before. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. And then, another representation that I think maybe you haven't seen before is what's called the Choi-Jamiokowski representation. Is this familiar? Yeah, okay, good. So I can tell you something new. So that's the following thing. So I'm going to define something which is called the Jamiokowski map. So this is something which, some map that sends E to some matrix. And what it is exactly what happens if you act with E on half of a maximally entangled state. So I take E tensored with the identity acting on the other half. And I'm going to take that thing acting on psi psi. And there are different conventions for what the normalization should be, but I'm going to write down what I think is the more standard one, which is that this thing is actually an unnormalized maximally entangled state. So this is the sum over I. Okay. So I take a maximally entangled state of whatever is the system that E acts on, together with some Ancilla system of the same dimension. Right, that's this maximally entangled state, and the way it's written here, I don't bother to normalize it. And then I act with E on half of that. So the condition is that this satisfies, that this is a positive semi-definite matrix, so that J of E is positive semi-definite. And the partial trace over the Ancilla system is 1, so that is the identity. So the trace over B of J of E is equal to the identity. So this is another way of thinking about E being a completely positive trace-preserving map, and sometimes this representation is a more useful way to think about things. And the fourth way of thinking about this is the way of thinking about this in terms of purification, the picture that's sometimes people call the church of the larger Hilbert space. You can always just think about the thing as unitary in a bigger Hilbert space. So if I put in, I can always come up with some unitary U, so that if I act on the composite system with U, and I have some Ancilla, which is initially in the zero state, then I can use that to realize E of rho, where, I may also have to discard part of the output, right? So take this thing and trace it out. Okay, so I guess the condition is that there exists a unitary U such that this works. It does that. Okay. All right. So, yes. Yeah. Right. Well, I guess we could check that that's what we get. For example, when this is the identity operation, right? So suppose, because that should definitely be a valid quantum operation. So. And if the normalization works for that, then it'll work in general. So suppose that E is actually also the identity, then this thing is going to be this unnormalized maximally entangled state, because just nothing happens to it. Then I trace out the other system, and you know, I'm taking the partial trace of, well, okay, I mean, maybe you can think about it the other way. Suppose I did normalize this, right? Then I'd have a 1 over root d here. This would be a normalized quantum state. And then what would I get out if I traced out the thing? Well, then what I would get out should be a density matrix. So it's going to have a factor of 1 over d, so that this thing is trace 1. But the way that it's written here, this thing is trace d. So, yeah. Okay, good. Other questions? Yes?
In 4i, is the ancillary system arbitrarily large or one bit?
Right, so I guess all that I'm saying here is that it... that there exists an ancilla system of some dimension. So I'm allowing it to be arbitrarily large. But you could ask, how large does it have to be for such a representation to exist? It's actually not necessary that you to allow it to be arbitrarily large. And I think you only have to allow it to be of dimension the same as the as this system. Maybe twice as big. I forget which is the case. Certainly twice as big will be enough. But I think it should be this, of the same dimension. Of the same dimension is enough?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that the dimension is squared, or that the...
Maybe
that the number of bits is, you know, could be twice as much, meaning that the dimension could be squared. Yeah, I don't remember this off the top of my head, actually. Yeah, I'm sorry. So you could think about that. I mean, another interesting question, by the way, is like, suppose you allowed this thing to be initialized in a mixed quantum state, then could you get by with a smaller dimension? And actually, sometimes you can get by with a smaller dimension if this thing is allowed to be mixed than if it's, you know, if it has to be, let's say, the zero state. But, anyway, I guess it's not a big deal. Okay. All right, so this is this picture of purifying things. This is sometimes called the Steinspring representation. So this U is sometimes called a Steinspring dilation. Okay. All right, so maybe I'll just give some very quick examples of these things, because, you know, I guess one of the reasons that I'm doing this is that we're going to have to, later on we're going to talk about error correction, quantum error correction, and so the kinds of errors that you might want to be able to protect against will be exactly, completely arbitrary, completely positive trace-preserving maps, but we might like to think about what are some of the kinds of quantum noise that we might have to protect against. So let me just quickly mention some examples, or maybe I'll just write down what the examples are, and you can tell me if you've seen all of them. We won't bother. So there's something called the depolarizing channel. There's something called phase damping. And there's something called amplitude damping. So these are all single qubit channels. So have you seen all of these before? Oh, in a tutorial. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So maybe I won't kind of belabor this. This is some kind of a channel that sort of moves you towards the maximally mixed state. This is something that only removes information about the phase. So, you know, if you think in terms of what happens to the Bloch sphere, so these are all operations on a qubit. So you could think about them in terms of what they do to the Bloch sphere picture. What this does is it sort of like kind of uniformly shrinks the Bloch sphere towards the maximally mixed state. What this does is that it sort of like, you know, it doesn't erase quantum information in the computational basis. So the states 0 and 1 stay where they are, but it kind of shrinks everything toward the z-axis of the Bloch sphere. And what amplitude damping does is this is sort of like, you know, something which is maybe taking energy out of the quantum system. So it's if this was, you know, where the Bloch sphere sat originally, amplitude damping is going to sort of maybe push you up towards the zero state. So these are all valid processes that are allowed by quantum mechanics, and these are the kinds of errors that you might have to correct against when you're trying to do error correction. You know, there are examples of things like this that you can actually think of as applying some unitary transformation chosen at random. So, you know, maybe I won't write down exactly how you would realize these things, but for the depolarizing channel and phase damping, there's some way of writing them in terms of the Krauss representation where all of the Krauss operators are proportional to unitaries so that you can interpret them as just applying some unitary operations chosen from some distribution. But this amplitude damping map doesn't have that property. So, I mean, in particular, you can see it's not what's called unital. The maximally mixed state is not a fixed point. Everything is going to get sent to the all zero state. So, you know, because of that, it's not going to be enough to just be, you know, thinking about correcting unitary errors and then thinking of an arbitrary channel as a convex combination of unitaries. There are some things that don't even have that property. Okay. But maybe I won't write down the definitions of these things if you've seen them before. Okay. All right, so the last thing that I wanted to do was just remind you about generalized measurement, because you know, very soon we're going to talk about quantum state distinguishability, and it'll be useful to have, well, I just want to remind you, like, what are the sorts of measurements that you can apply in quantum mechanics in general. Okay, so, you know, so far we've only used, well, we've really only used measurements in the computational basis, so, you know, basically just the concept that you can perform some von Neumann measurement, but there's a more general thing which is allowed. So the most general kind of measurement that's allowed by quantum mechanics is something that's defined as follows. So you're going to have a set of operators M sub I, which are just you know, basically completely arbitrary operators, except that they have to satisfy the following condition, that the sum over I of MI dagger MI should be the identity. So these are called measurement operators. And what's the Born rule? What's the rule that says, you know, the probabilities that you get different outcomes when you measure on a quantum state? Well, the probability that we get some particular outcome I when we perform this measurement is given by the trace of MI dagger MI rho. So that's the probability distribution we see when we perform this measurement. And now you see why this thing should sum to the identity, because, you know, if that's satisfied, then here, when we sum up over all of the i's, we'll just get the trace of rho, which is 1. So something will happen. But then the other thing we can say is, you know, what is the post-measurement state? And the post-measurement state that we get if we see the outcome I is the following thing. So it's mi rho mi dagger. So the state is proportional to that, but to normalize things, we have to divide by the probability that we got the outcome I. So the trace of MI dagger MI rho. So this is, you know, a generalization of what we have when we perform a von Neumann measurement. This is just the completely arbitrary, you know, kind of the most general measurement that quantum mechanics would allow. You can always realize such a thing. So, you know, again, there's some picture of purification, that you could always realize such a measurement by adjoining some ancilla system, performing some unitary on your entire system, and then measuring the output. Right? So, so this is how you can, for example, get measurements that have more outcomes than the dimension of the space that you're working with. So yeah, I guess I have some picture of that here, that you can always realize such a thing unitarily like this. So we're going to have something which is going to give us the post-measurement state. Then, you know, we'll have some register that we measure that's going to give us the outcome I, and there may be also some piece that we discard. So that's kind of the purification picture for measurements. And now this is the, you know, kind of the most general notion of measurement you can have, but in many cases you might not care about the post-measurement state. You might just want to extract some information from the quantum system, and you might only care about the probability distribution, and you're never going to do anything with the state afterward. So if that's the case, then actually all you care about are not the operators M sub I, but just these particular combinations of them, M sub I dagger times M sub I. And if you take those things, then you get what's called a POVM. So a POVM, or a positive operator valued measure, is going to be a bunch of operators E sub I that have the property that they're a partition of the identity. So the sum over I, E sub I should be the identity. And these operators should be Hermitian. So e sub I should be equal to e sub I dagger. And furthermore, they should be positive semi-definite, right? Which is of course always the case for an operator of this form. So e sub I should be greater than or equal to zero. Right? So this is called a POVM. And if we have a state rho and we perform the POVM described by the POVM operators e sub I, then the probability that we get the outcome I is just the trace of e sub I times rho. So sometimes it's more convenient to just think about POVMs if you don't care about the post-measurement state. If you just know what the POVM is, you can't uniquely figure out what the post-measurement state is going to be, because you know there's not a unique way to factorize these e sub i's in this form. And so you throw away some information if you only think about POVMs, but maybe that's information that you don't care about. So it's common to sometimes just think about these POVMs. And now sometimes if we want to distinguish quantum states, it could be that we're better off thinking about, this cupcake is like just, this is brutal. It's just like been staring at me through this whole lecture. Okay. So there are examples where you can do better by performing one of these generalized measurements. So say by doing a POVM, than by just performing a von Neumann measurement. So one example of that case that we won't analyze in detail, but I just want to mention it, is what are called the trine states. So if we just look, let's say, you know, on the equator of the Bloch sphere, we look at three states which are, you know, they have angles 2 pi over 3 with respect to each other in the Bloch sphere, so they're kind of equally separated from each other, and you prepare one of these states, each with probability a third, and you want to guess which state was given to you, then it turns out that the best thing to do to figure out what these states are is to perform a POVM. Right? So the measurement, so you know, I have this with probability a third, this with probability a third, this with probability a third, and then the measurement that distinguishes them with the highest success probability is a POVM. And if you haven't thought about this before, if you haven't seen this example before, it's kind of a fun exercise to try to figure out what is the measurement that will distinguish these states as well as possible. You can sort of use some symmetry considerations to narrow down the space of things that you might think about, but there's still, you know, several measurements that you could try to do, and you could try to think about what's really the measurement that's going to be the best. You sort of want to have a measurement that has three outcomes, despite the fact that this is just the state of a qubit. So that's, I mean, I guess that's part of the reason that you want to do a general POVM and not just a von Neumann measurement. Okay. Questions? Okay, so that was my really quick review of open quantum systems. So I guess maybe we'll stop there, and next time we'll talk about some distance measures for quantum states and quantum entropy, which will be useful in thinking about some quantum information, well, some further quantum information theory. Okay, thanks.